I'm John Uhas, along with my co-counsel, Christian Milhouse, and representing the council in this case, 15. I do, just to give us a bit of a background, this police report, want to briefly address some of the facts. The victim's body, Mrs. Duffco, was found in her home in early January 1989, January 3rd, and Mr. Spivey was arrested the day after, taken to the hospital for assault and taken wounds. A couple of weeks later, he was indicted by direct sentencing and his trial. So now we're talking about the middle of January, January 18th of 89. And his trial was set for the end of March, March 27th. Just a few weeks after the arraignment, the defense lawyers came to the trial court and said, Your Honor, we have to continue this case set for March 27th because we're having problems getting discovery from the state. I think that's important in light of what's coming down the road in terms of the DNA testing and the effect of the plea of no contest that the appellant later entered. The trial court, when the defense lawyers came and said we need a continuance, we're not getting the test results and the discovery from the government as we should, continued the case all the way until the fall, until early September. I have to confess that as I read the record, I was sometimes a bit confused. I'm not sure it was completely clear. The defense lawyers were constantly saying in the pretrial hearings, the motion hearings that were taking place over the summer, that we've been assured that these items are going to be tested and that we're going to be providing this discovery. They continue to complain. And again, I'll be the first to admit that they're not always real clear about exactly what it is they want, but they are continuously complaining to Judge Economist that we're not getting these things. In late August, from the record, it becomes apparent to the trial lawyers that the government is not going to have certain items tested and subjected to DNA analysis. And there are some comments in the record from one of the defense lawyers, Mr. Zena, who makes clear that he had off-the-record discussions with the prosecutor that these things were going to be done. When the trial lawyers discover from a discovery disclosure in August that the testing is not going to be done, they then say, we would like money and we would like time to have these items tested. Suffice it to say that although Judge Economist gave him that authority, gave them the authority to have the testing done, the testing was not completed by the time of the trial. The trial was again reset. And what I think is troubling from what's in the record is that, first of all, there is a waiver of the jury trial. Then, after the waiver of the jury trial, of course, the three-judge panel has to be selected. And after the three-judge panel is selected, then there's just this discussion about the no contest plea. What I think is particularly troubling from the record about that is that at one point Judge Economist said, now, I want to make it clear here, you're not doing all this stuff just because you're not getting this discovery, this DNA testing. And Mr. Chrisbaum, one of the lawyers for the appellant, Mr. Spivey, says, well, that is a consideration. And I think it's a fair reading of the record, Your Honors, that there is some element of coercion here because the defense lawyers are assured all through the proceedings that they're going to get this discovery. When they realize they're not going to get the discovery, they ask to have independent testing done. The trial judge says, yes, but I'm not going to continue the case so that you can get these things.
There was a risk to, the DNA testing, as it turned out, was something it did match the blood of the victim on the defendant's clothing. But it's argued that the timing, that at the time of entering the plea, there was an upside to the defendant for making that choice at that time, and that was that there was an agreement not to, not to seek the death penalty. And is that, you're asking, the argument you're making is that it was error not to let Mr. Spivey withdraw his plea of no contest and or ineffective assistance, both?
Well, both. And one of the things that we're saying is that Mr. Spivey really was not effecting a waiver of the jury trial and then later entering a plea of no contest knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily.
But there was no, I mean, no continuance was denied. Like this, the time of entering the plea, it sounds like what we really have is counsel saying, yeah, but I think I'm still going to do it. I know that DNA's not in yet, and you know what? It's still a good deal.
I have to differ with you a little bit on that, Justice Cook, because there were some continuances granted, and I agree with you that many continuances were granted.
Yeah.
But then the trial judge put an entry on saying, no further continuances, and actually, at the time that the plea is entered, the DNA is not back. And one of the things that Mr. Crisfon, one of the defense lawyers, is saying, and he's responding to what Judge Economist said. Judge Economist says, I want the record to be clear here. I want it to look like you're doing this because I won't grant a continuance and you don't have this stuff back. And Mr. Crisfon says, well, Your Honor, I'll agree that that's not the only concern here, but that is, in fact, a concern. So I think there is some coercion here. And where we think that ties in, Your Honor, is obviously the waiver of the jury trial and the entry of the plea of no contest have to be done knowingly, voluntarily, and intelligently. We, of course, don't know from the record what happens in the room where the lawyers are talking to Mr. Spivey saying, listen, son, we've tried to get this testing, but the judge is not, the testing is not going to be back, and we're not going to have the results in time. We've got to make a decision here. Are we going to trial, or are we going to enter a plea? We don't know all that from the record. What we're saying is one of the problems here, given, and this is in conjunction with Mr. Spivey's limited mental ability, is that the trial judge didn't do enough at the time that the jury waiver was put on, and the trial judge did not do enough at the time that the plea of no contest was accepted.
That's a tough argument to make, counsel. You're asking that, I mean, your argument isn't that the standards under Rule 11 were not met. It's that it's really a subjective test of the particular defendant's mental abilities, what more a court should do.
I have to agree with you, Your Honor. And by that, what I mean is, of course, we're not asking for some new standard under criminal rule 11. On the other hand, we think that some of the cases that we've cited, including cases from the Ohio court, say, but when you have a defendant and you know that the limited abilities are there, the limited mental abilities, you ought to take some extra steps. And if I can just, by example, for 10 seconds tell you, last week I was involved in a criminal case where the defendant happened to be a lawyer. Well, he's a licensed practicing lawyer, and although the rote of criminal rule 11 has to be gone through, you've got to ask the guy to waive your right to a jury trial, the whole nine yards. No one would suggest that that can't be done in any way other than going through it rote by rote. But on the other hand, when you've got a defendant that you know from the evaluation, from the NGRI plea, and the other mental evaluations that were done, that you've got a slow person, then we're saying, and we think the Ohio cases support that, that you ought to go a bit further, that you ought to not just say, you understand that you're giving up your right to have the state produce witnesses to prove you're guilty on a reasonable doubt. Of course, that's a rogue thing that you might do with that lawyer, but do you do that with a defendant of limited mental abilities? We think not. We think that you have to go further, particularly in a capital case. And one of the things that we suggested in here is that the United States Supreme Court has said, back in 87, I believe, in a case called Berger versus Kemp, that in a capital case, the obligation of the court to search out and ferret out constitutional errors is never more imposing or important than in a capital case. We're suggesting here that because this is a capital case, because there was a person of limited mental abilities, that the trial judge should have gone further and should not have just engaged in this rote, Mr. Spivey, do you understand that you're giving up your right to a trial by jury, or at the time of the plea that you're giving up your right to have the state produce witnesses to prove your guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, or to confront witnesses against you. I think all of our experiences have shown that people who have limited mental abilities, when they get in the intimidating setting of a courtroom, lawyers and judges, and I'm in trouble, and the judge says, you understand this? Yes. You understand this? Yes. Many times people with those limited mental abilities don't go further, and if they have a question or if they don't understand, they won't don't say so.
So you're placing the entire burden upon the judge that this person was represented by an attorney, and you don't think that it's sufficient, the fact that no doubt there was discussions prior to the entrance of this plea between the client and the attorney. It seems to me what you're saying is that the judge has to, you know, presume that this defendant doesn't really know anything, doesn't understand what he's doing. I don't understand that.
I'm not saying that in every case, Your Honor. What I am saying is, first of all, there's a twofold responsibility. I think we all know from the competency statute and from the cases interpreting the competency statute that there's an obligation on counsel. In fact, even in a competent situation, there's an obligation on the prosecutor. If the prosecutor thinks the guy's incompetent and no one else raises it, it's the prosecutor's obligation. So I think there is an obligation on the part of the counsel. But if, for whatever reason, and again, we're limited to what's in the record, obviously, we don't know if these guys are back there saying, son, you're going to get slammed dunk. This is the thing you've got to do. We don't know that from the record. What I am saying, though, Justice Resnick, is that if, in some cases, as here, where we've got...
What I'm wondering, how is the judge going to make that determination? How is he going to know this is a case that he should take greater pains with, unless the defense attorney says to him, says to the judge, perhaps the defendant doesn't understand what he's doing. I still see it's a twofold responsibility. I would think that the defense attorney has to call it to the judge's attention.
I don't disagree with that, but what I'm suggesting is that if the defense lawyer does not call it to the attention of the trial judge, that from other facts and circumstances that might be present. And here, there was an NGRI plea, there were mental evaluations done. This is a guy with an IQ of 76 and a mental age of 10. That should put a judge on notice that he's in essence taking a plea from a second grader, as opposed to, for example, that lawyer that I just talked about last week. So while I agree with you that it is a twofold obligation, that is the defense lawyer and the trial judge, I don't want the court to misappreciate the argument by us saying that if the defense lawyer falls down on his responsibility, there is still the ultimate responsibility of the trial court to make sure that the waiver is knowing, intelligent, and voluntary.
So is your best argument to attempt to defeat the conviction the mental defect, or are you arguing that for putting aside the death penalty only, or conviction and the death penalty?
Well, I'm saying the conviction and the death penalty, Your Honor, because I'm saying that the plea of no contest was not done knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily. So, of course, the conviction is the basis for the death penalty. One of the other things about that, if I may, Your Honor, we cited a case in here where I recognize it was a dissent by Justice Marshall from the U.S. Supreme Court case, but he suggested a point that I think that it is not inappropriate for consideration here, particularly, again, when you have someone of limited mental abilities, and that's the point that if you don't explain to a person who's waiving a jury trial in a capital case, listen, you understand that part of what you're doing when you waive a jury is you give your right or your opportunity to break a jury deadlines that a death sentence is being imposed. And that clearly was not done in this case either.
Let's assume that we reverse the conviction here. It goes back for trial, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
It goes back for trial. He could then be tried again with the death penalty specification.
Yes, sir.
Is that what you really want in this case? I guess where I'm going with it, isn't the evidence pretty overwhelming with regard to guilt? And would not your stronger argument be in mitigation?
Well, if I may, let me say two things about that. First of all, although there is strong evidence, I don't know that I would classify it as overwhelming. There are a couple of statements, and of course the motion to suppress will overrule on that. But those statements indicate that Mr. Spivey said, I was there, but there was another guy there. I recognize there are some problems with that. And I guess what I'm saying is, if it can be demonstrated that Mr. Spivey understands that, listen, if you want to go to trial knowing that they found all this evidence on you, the woman's driver's license and those kind of things. They found you driving the woman's car. You were seen near the woman's house. If you want to go to trial with that, and with your version that, look, I was at the house, but I was with this guy, John, I left to get cigarettes, and John must have been the guy that killed her.
He didn't quite say that, though, did he? He said that John and he were there, but he never said John did it.
No, that's true. He did not. But, of course, he didn't say that he did it either, and although he doesn't say John did it, I guess he leaves one and could leave a juror with the impression that John did it. And that may, of course, be important when we're talking about specifications where he's alleged to be the principal defendant, as was the case here. The other thing I want to say about that in response to your question, Justice Douglas, is, and maybe I'm going to sound a bit finicky about this, I don't know. I don't think it's a question of what I want. I think it's a question of, this is a capital case, and we have to try to dot the I's and cross the T's, and if that means that we have to go back, and maybe the ultimate thing that happens is Warren Spivey, after he looks at the DNA result and talks to whoever his trial lawyers are, says, okay, I do want to enter a guilty plea, or I do want to enter a plea of no contest. If all that's done appropriately, that is, interrogating him as to, do you really understand what you're doing here, then that's the way it has to be done. But to say on appeal, well, you know what, you really want this because the guy's overwhelmingly guilty and should we really bother doing all this, I think adherence to the Constitution requires.
We're looking for what law might come out of this case. If we adopt your first proposition of law, isn't that just saying what has been said for 100 years? The court must determine that any waiver of the right is knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily made.
Perhaps.
I mean, that's always been the law.
Well, as I understand it, one of the things this court does, of course, is expand upon or define or delineate what rules of law are. That knowing voluntarily and intelligent thing has been around, at least that I can think of, since Johnson versus Zerk.
Okay, now, is that determination in this case a factual or a legal one? Are we looking at factually that he did not knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily waive? Or are we saying that's an error of law?
Because I actually think that they're
both. Both, okay.
And what I mean by that is, and where I think that a decision in this case can add to the knowledge for the trial judges of this state is to say, listen, first of all, when it's a capital case, be pretty specific.
Well, we have a five-page, I've never seen quite an extensive written plea of no contest in a capital case or any felony case as we have in this particular case. And yet you're saying that this defendant didn't understand what he was doing. Didn't the court go over every aspect of this with him, these five pages, or did they just ask him to sign it?
No, they went over.
That's what I
thought. No question, they went over it. However, if you look at what most of, and I don't have it in front of me, but my recollection of what that plea form says, a good part of it doesn't really address the waiver, it addresses the elements of the offenses and the specifications.
All of which, the waivers are here. All of them, it goes through A, B, C, D, all the rights that he's giving up. As I said, I've never seen a plea that extensive.
I'm not saying that the waiver, I didn't mean to imply that the waivers are not there, but what I am saying is that a good portion of the body of that plea is setting forth information about the charges and the specifications, whereas in the normal guilty pleas that I'm used to seeing and being involved with, there's a line that says, my lawyer has explained all the elements of the offenses. Here, those are all spelled out. In terms of the waiver, Your Honor, I don't see that there's any more extensive of a discussion in that plea form of the waivers of constitutional rights than there is in any standard guilty plea form that comes before the court. That in this particular case, it was error for the trial court, after the test results were received, not to allow the defendant to withdraw his plea. Obviously, we have cited the cases, and I think the rule in Ohio is pretty clear that a motion to withdraw a guilty plea or a no contest plea should be freely granted before sentencing, otherwise not. Here, it was before sentencing. Some of the cases, admittedly, and even the Court of Appeals opinion in this case, talked about the discretion that's afforded the trial judge. Don't want to suggest to you that that's not the law, or that shouldn't be applied, but in this particular case, it seems to me there was not enough of an evidentiary hearing or an argument hearing where the defense lawyers could say, this is why Mr. Spivey wants to withdraw his plea. The cases that I've seen and that we've cited where the appellate courts have said it was an abuse of discretion have talked about simply saying, you're not permitted to do this, you're not permitted to withdraw your plea, I don't want to hear anything about it. Here, we don't think that there was enough of an inquiry by the court as to why should I consider doing this. It is before sentencing, therefore it's to be freely done, but at the same time, I, the trial judge, have discretion. If I think you're doing this to pull the wool over my eyes, I don't have to do it, so let me hear something about that. And in this particular case, again, we can probably stand here and banter about what that evidence meant. Is that evidence that's going to make or break the case? I don't know, because I'm not a jury. The point is, if Mr. Spivey, whose obligation in the court's obligation to see that he knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily waived those rights, if Mr. Spivey said, well, wait a minute, now I have this information, doggone it, if I had known this, I would not have waived my right to a jury trial, or I would not have waived my right to have a trial and enter a plea in no contest. And what I'm suggesting is that his DNA test results show a non-frivolous reason for the withdrawal of the plea of no contest because it was before sentencing. The trial court should have done that. The Ohio case that talks about that rule goes back to some federal authorities, and those federal authorities, as we said in the brief, said, look, the inconvenience to the court and the prosecutor and everybody else is minimal compared to the importance of us honoring the Constitution. And of course, we honor the Constitution by making sure that when the defendant enters a no contest plea, he does so knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily.
Counsel, your time's winding down, and yeah. I think where Justice Douglas was trying to take you is the penalty phase. Could you address that?
Particularly the mental defect.
And the conditions under which he lived as a young person. He's 19 years old when he committed the crime, and as you know, there we've commented on that before, where a person that age commits a crime having lived in a atmosphere of abuse and so forth, which it seems to me the defendant did here. So why don't you, I'd like to hear that too.
Obviously the record is, the defense lawyer did an excellent job of establishing what Mr. Spivey's life was like growing up. The convulsions, the whole nine yards. We're saying a couple of things about that. First of all, the opinion of the trial court as we see it suggests that the trial court viewed itself as under a mandatory obligation to impose death if it saw that the, or if in its estimation, the aggravating circumstances outweigh the factors in mitigation. We're saying that that's a problem with the statute, that the statute is structured in such a way that it doesn't allow a trial court to do what a jury can do, which is to go back in the jury room and say, look, these are substantial aggravating circumstances. There's a lot of mitigating evidence here, but we don't think that the mitigating evidence is enough to justify not imposing the death penalty. So looking at it objectively as possible, we have to vote for death. But a jury, of course, can say, but doggone it, even though I've been as objective about it as I can, I've still got the option to, in essence, extend mercy.
So is the trial judge. The trial judge has absolutely that. If the trial judge, he or she says, mitigation is not outweighed by aggravation, then the judge doesn't even have to accept the jury's recommendation.
He does not, Your Honor.
It's what we come down to in every one of these cases. Every time I pick up that pen and start writing one, you're in a position where you think, And here I am balancing. And it's purely subjective. I would concede that to you. Which side of the scale is heavier? And very often we come down on the side of the aggravating circumstance or circumstances. That's what, but the trial judge certainly has that option, and so does the Court of Appeals, as do we. Isn't that right?
That is correct.
So it's a stronger option, maybe even than the jury, or just as strong.
I'm sorry.
It's a stronger option than the jury has, or at least just equally as strong.
I have to differ with you a little bit. Here's where I differ. One of the things that we suggested is that, and this is, I realize it's not a popular thing to say standing where I am, but one of the things that we suggested is that some of the appellate opinions in this state have led judges and juries to believe that those types of things are not proper. And in regard to mercy, now, you just said that a trial judge has the option to extend that as, just as it does a jury. Well, that seems to be the case law, but only if those folks innately know that, because I believe your decision in Moraine has pretty much said that that's something not to be considered because it's not a mitigating factor.
Okay, counsel, are you suggesting, and I believe you are, that a three-judge panel does not have the same latitude as a jury when it gets the sentencing case, that it's constrained in ways that a jury would not be?
You're going to love this answer, Your Honor. In a qualified way, yes, that is what I'm saying. And I'm saying that because we believe that the way the statute is structured, that is written in mandatory terms, if the aggravating circumstances outweigh the mitigating factors beyond a reasonable doubt, then death shall be imposed. Now, of course, there are a myriad of decisions that say that a three-judge panel is presumed to know the law, whereas a jury is not necessarily presumed to know the law. So we're saying that the way the statute is both structured and applied, that there is a greater likelihood of a three-judge panel not exercising a mercy discretion or a mercy option. Because a jury doesn't feel, it's less likely that a jury is going to follow the letter of the law exactly back of the jury room. They may engage in that weighing process, but when they're done, still decide to extend mercy. Trial judges may say, geez, I feel sorry for this guy, and if I had my own brothers in this particular case, I would not impose the penalty. However, when I read the statute, being as objective about it as I can as a trial judge, the aggravating circumstances outweigh the mitigating factors beyond a reasonable doubt. Therefore, I must impose the death penalty.
Well, if your legal theory is correct, wouldn't it be ineffective assistance of counsel to ever weigh the jury then?
In a capital case?
Yes.
It is my personal opinion that that is exactly the case.
I mean, it seems to me that logically follows it. I mean, if your legal analysis is correct as to the constraints of a three-judge panel, then it would never be
anything but
ineffective assistance of counsel to waive.
Well, I am of the opinion that that's exactly what it is in a capital case. For reasons that we just talked about, and also for those reasons that Justice Marshall talked about in that dissent in the California case, where it has to be explained to a defendant that, look, if just one person doesn't agree here, you don't get the death sentence.
But counsel, your theory includes the non-legal viewpoint that juries aren't less or unwilling to follow the law. So that isn't, that's an assessment, your whole analysis that comes to the conclusion that it would always be an effective assistance counsel to weigh the jury includes this nuance that juries who have to follow the same law as the judge don't. And that's not a legal conclusion in there. That's a view we have, that they would be less able to do it. They would react more humanly.
Well, Your Honor, I would have to say that what is good for the goose is good for the gander. And what I mean by that is that what you say is true. However, many appellate opinions that I have seen that talk about ineffective assistance of counsel factor in the strategy.
I don't discount it, but it isn't a wholly legal theory that you have there.
Absolutely not. But I think that what a lawyer does as part of strategy does impact on
counsel, your red light's about to come on, and you still have not given us a strong pitch for why your client should not get the death penalty. Could you do that? Isn't that your job?
Well, isn't that
your job?
Sure, Your Honor. Although I think part of the job is to send the proceeding back so it's done right. In this particular case, as aggravated murders go, it is not a multiple murder. There is some evidence to suggest that Mr. Spivey may not have been the principal defendant, although certainly he did enter a plea. If we're going to look at mitigating factors under the statute, then I think Mr. Spivey has a compelling case. First of all, he's 19 years old. Second of all, what happened to Mr. Spivey is absolutely explainable by what his entire life pattern has been. Sexual abuse, a history of convulsion since age one, mother not taking him to the doctor, a life of rejection.
Well, in fact, she took him to the doctor, but then when he seemed to make progress, she didn't take him. And she told him that she hated him, where she hadn't been born. You have a pretty strong case for mitigation, which I guess I'm, Justice Pfeiffer, I guess I agree. I'd like to hear your argument on that.
Including mental defect.
He had a mental defect. He was the only medical evidence on that point that was really admitted. The trial court referred to evidence that apparently wasn't even admitted. But that was that he was operating at a level of 10 years old. Here we've got somebody who had no chance in life from his home, from his number one, his mental defect, and then the conditions under which he lived. State v. Murphy, at least three of us said that was a strong mitigating factors, or those were strong mitigating factors. Are they the same here, or do you not seem to? And your red light's on, and now we get to it. I guess I'm wondering, too, why you wouldn't emphasize. That seems to me to be your strongest point, frankly. Beyond the guilt phase. I know that you want to have it reversed and sent back for a new trial, but the mitigation phase here seems to me to be very important. Mitigating factors, rather.
Your Honor, I agree with that.
I just made your argument for you. Right?
You did. I thought that I had already made it.
Well, you did in your brief. Right.
Of any of the cases that I've seen or read about, certainly this guy, although he does not have the lowest IQ of the opinions that I've seen in your cases, certainly his life history is as bad as anyone's. And if there is to be, and Justice Douglas said that, you sit there and you attempt to weigh the aggravating circumstances against the mitigating factors, and how do you do that? Well, I guess the only way you do it is when you look at those mitigating factors and you say, this is a horrible thing that this man did, but geez, oh man, look where he came from. What happened from the time that this woman brought home this cuddly little baby until he turned into this big 19-year-old guy who did something very wrong? I think the mitigation record can't explain that.
Mr. Uhas, let me ask you a question. Last week we had a death case in which the mitigating factors argued to us were that the defendant didn't have a criminal record, had a fairly normal upbringing, and now he's been convicted of murder and he's got the death penalty. Mitigating factors were that this is somebody who is just the opposite, 180 degrees from your defendant, from your client. Is there any inconsistency in your mind that we would look at those two different sorts of mitigating factors as outweighing the aggravating circumstances? Do you think it's consistent for us to do that?
No. Well, first of all, I would have to say that they don't have to outweigh the aggravating circumstances.
Right.
Secondly, no. And I think there's not time, obviously, for me to stand here and tell you everything that I think is wrong with the death penalty statute, but I think that what has to happen is a look at cases on a case-by-case situation. And you can look at setting A, which is Mr. Spivey, with a horrible childhood, low intelligence, all those things, and say, geez, these are reasons that mitigate against the ultimate punishment. These are reasons that mitigate against, for example, a guy who just walks out and cold-bloodedly blows away six or seven people. At the same time, I don't think that those have to be the mitigating factors for this court to say, this is a guy who shouldn't get the death penalty. He never had a chance. maybe the court should also be looking at a guy who does have a chance, who doesn't have a criminal record, who appears to do okay in school, have a well-adjusted family life, but for whatever reason, and I don't know the facts of the case we're talking about,
sure,
snaps on a given day and does something completely out of character. Should that person also get the, should that person get the death penalty? I don't think so, because just as the bad life of Mr. Spivey may explain where he is, the good life of this other person may say, well, here's where he is, but here's why we should not impose the ultimate punishment.
And in considering that, though, don't we also have to take into consideration, if we're thinking of an alternative penalty, either life with parole in 30 years or life with parole in 20 years, that it has to be a person who is subject to rehabilitation, and shouldn't that be taken into consideration when you're weighing that question whether the individual should get the death penalty or get life, when we're considering that parole is an option?
I think it should, Justice Resnick, but the difficulty with that is that, whereas I can see that would be something that this court would want to do at this level, frankly, strategically at the trial court level, that's a difficult thing to do, because
I was asking it more for at our level, that we do have to take that into consideration.
And the reason I'm going to that little diatribe is to suggest to you that you may not always have the evidence in front of you from the record, because as a matter of strategy, the lawyers may not put on evidence of that effect. I can recall a capital case that I tried in Summit County where we had that kind of evidence, that the defendant adjusted well in jail, but we were given the composition of the jury, afraid to put that evidence forward, that the jury might say, well, if he's going to do well in jail, that might be too good for the son of a gun, let's just give him the electric chair. So while that is something that you would want to consider, I sometimes fear that you don't have the record necessary to do so.
Thank you, Mr. Uhas. The appellee, not having filed a timely brief, there's no more arguments. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.